Welcome to the 90s Podcast, an aviation podcast, episode 11. Today's episode special guest is Daniel Bolton. He's an Australian floatplane pilot, currently flying from Darwin in the Northern Territories of Australia. He's as well the host of the podcast and YouTube channel On the Step with That Mallard Guy. Daniel, thank you very much for joining me on the 90s Podcast. It's a real pleasure having you here.
Mate, great to be here. Really appreciate you inviting me on and chatting all things seaplanes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not very common to chat about seaplanes, especially in Hong Kong. We don't have a lot of seaplanes, you know. But I think at Darwin, you have a lot. You're from Darwin?
Not originally from Darwin, mate. I'm from a town called Geelong, which is down near Melbourne. You grew up down there, but I've been living in Darwin here for the last three and a bit years now, flying the Grumman Mallard for Paspaley Aviation, based out of Darwin, yeah.
So you come from just next from Melbourne city. That's where you just began the aviation?
Yeah, so Geelong's about an hour drive south of Melbourne there. So I grew up down there, got into aviation after leaving school. Flying for me is in the blood. My dad was a commercial pilot. He still is, not flying currently, but he still holds a commercial license. My grandfather was a World War II Spitfire pilot and also Tiger Moth instructor. And my uncle was a 747 captain at Qantas for 40 years. So, yeah, aviation definitely in the blood. I didn't actually really know what I wanted to do with my career outside of school until I was probably about year 11, about 17 years old. My old man, Greg, he started a seaplane company in Geelong. He was originally in the police force for most of his career. He did a bit of flying in the police force, but when I was about 13, 14, he started a seaplane company in my hometown. I didn't live with him growing up. My parents had separated when I was younger. But when it got to the end of high school and I kind of needed to find out, what do I need to focus on next year out of school there, aviation started to really become something that I could achieve. So I decided to go down that path. And outside of school, I did my training down in Geelong there with no intention to get into seaplane flying. My old man at the time, Greg, he said that the aviation industry was really hiring for looking for pilots at the time. It was around 2006, 2007, and that was the case. And then when I finished my license a year and a half later, the GFC had hit and there was really no jobs. So he kind of led me down the garden path a little bit there. I waited for about 6 months doing my supermarket job, and then the summer down there, his business was getting quite busy every summer, and he wanted a second pilot for the summer, so I did my float plane rating there and came on board to help him out with his company, flying a Cessna 206 straight float seaplane down at the waterfront there. So yeah, it was it was so much fun, and that was my first job as well. So it was just awesome to work with my old man and fly a straight float seaplane around my hometown, which was very cool as well. So yeah, I spent a year and a half flying down there.
Yeah, so your father was your instructor at that time.
He wasn't my instructor. I went through and did my commercial license at the flight school, which was actually literally 5 minutes from my house, which was amazing. That Geelong Airport doesn't actually exist anymore. It's a housing estate. So I was pretty lucky there, because otherwise the drive would have been around about an hour and 20 minutes to up into Melbourne there to do some flight training. So I was very lucky to have the Geelong Airport so close. And then when it came to the seaplane flying, I did my float plane endorsement in Melbourne at Melbourne Seaplanes, which was only a two-day course, a bit of ground school, and then the flight training on the aeroplane. So I did a bit of ICUS, what you'd call in command on a supervision flying with Dad. At the start, obviously, it wasn't just here's the keys, off you go, have fun. I did a few. I did some solo circuits by myself to get used to the plane. Then he went out and we did, about 2 weeks worth of ICUS, getting used to flying the route that Dad wanted me to fly. And then also just kind of getting to know the area a little bit. Where we docked the plane was a really tough little docking. It was kind of in this key, if you imagine like a rectangle, we were right in the corner of the rectangle there, and it was a fixed pontoon. So you had to kind of, you only had one approach to this pontoon, which you kind of had to follow the path of the rectangle, but then kind of shut it down and dock right in the corner there. And it didn't matter what way the wind was going, you always had to do the docking that way. So it was actually, yeah, it was a big learning curve, but it was a really tough little spot to dock in there. But yeah, so he wasn't my instructor, but yeah, he taught me a lot of things, that's for sure. And a lot of things about how to grab people on the streets and talk them into a seaplane flight. That's one thing that he taught me the most, yeah.
Is that a bit weird to fly with your father? I mean, sometimes father to son relationship can be tense, but it should be pretty nice to fly with your father, especially when he gives you all the knowledge you just need.
Yeah, no, that's a great question because, he really pushed me and really wanted me to do my best, push me down this. Basically, he was happy for me to take all the flying. As a son, I think he wanted, his son to excel, you know what I mean? So I think if it was any other pilot, maybe he would have done things a little bit differently. Maybe he would have shared the flying around a little bit more with himself. Maybe he would have put them on the ground a little bit longer to get used to the operation. But being his son, I think maybe he pushed me down the deep end a little bit. And maybe also in the cockpit as that relationship as kind of the senior pilot versus the junior pilot, it might have been a bit different as well. It's hard to explain, but yeah, like he was great. He was a really skilled pilot, and some of the stuff we used to do with the 206 was amazing. Like, for example, we had these channel markers where the boats would come into the Geelong Harbour there. So this harbour this bay called Corio Bay is just off Port Phillip Bay, which is the bay that goes up to Melbourne there. So some of the ships would come in and they would, I think most of them were oil tankers and whatnot, and they had these big pylons in the water there for the ships to come in through. And Dad and I used to go out there, and one thing he used to talk about with float plane flying was eyes out all the time. And you use your hands to feel places in the cockpit. So the flaps, you're feeling for the flaps if you want to change from 0 to 10. Your eyes are always out, but you're feeling for things. You're feeling for the throttle. Obviously, some things you can't just feel for, like gauges where you got to check things. But so we used to fly around these pylons, and Dad would make me change power and change pitch and change the flap settings and – all whilst doing basically almost a bit like a Red Bull, air race of going around all of the pylons there. It wasn't as harder turns as what those guys did, but it really taught you. I mean, float plane flying is all about being eyes outside, and you might have a river where you have to follow a canyon down and really hit a spot. It's really important in float plane flying that you are focusing outside the airplane a lot. Being able to feel for those spots like flaps and power is critical,
Yeah, a lot of situational awareness and as well weather awareness, meteorological awareness as well. You just don't have to be tricked by something, for example, by, flying low on legs with some very big trees. You have some air streams coming on and you can have some turbulences and pretty strong wind variations.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you talk about wind, there's this thing called a bullet. I don't know if you've ever heard of that saying, but a bullet in seaplane flying is like this wind gust that comes across the water there. And you can see it quite clearly, just like a wind line. I'm sure you've probably gone out boating before and you can it's all still and then you can actually see the wind coming on the water there. So that's what we call like a bullet. And things that islands, trees, any obstacles on the water there can affect how they come around that obstacle and how they affect on the water. And, you might be ready to land, and if you hit one of those bullets, you will get an increase in lift and then you will balloon up kind of thing. So managing all that is critical. A lot of the seaplane flying in Australia, especially down in Geelong there, the terrain is not hugely an issue. Obviously, Australia is a very flat country. So a lot of the flying we do generally, or most of the stuff that I've done has been kind of in some pretty flat areas, yeah.
Yeah, you do only sea flights in Australia? Do you have a kind of lake areas on which you can land?
I'm not sure what I don't think there is any I'm trying to think actually now, but I don't think there is any seaplane operators in Australia that are actually operating on a freshwater lake. Like you mentioned before, like on my own podcast there, on the step there, I talk to a lot of seaplane flights pilots all around the world, and America has just some incredible lake systems that I would love to go and check out. I mean, the famous Jack Brown's seaplane base in Florida there, you know, I've spoken to a few pilots that operate floats out of there, and I had to Google map the area, and it's just lake after lake after lake. You know, these lakes are so close together. It's incredible. We don't have that in Australia at all. So a lot of the flying that we do is coastal, salt water, and in our case in the Mallard, they're open ocean as well. So
yeah, that's why it's very expanded in North America, the floodplain operations, because they need that. They have, I think, pretty desert areas they need to go to, and they need to do that because of the density of lakes. What's your basic operation in Australia? I mean, you do only charter flights, scenic flights with the seaplanes?
Yeah, so with that first company that I worked for in Geelong, it was mainly scenic flights. So it was my dad's company was simply a one plane. It probably didn't even really need two pilots, but I kind of came on board and helped out, especially over the summer period there. It was predominantly just scenic flights. So, you know, you walk down the waterfront there and, you know, taking the girlfriend out for a walk, and there's the seaplane, mm-hmm. And there's me trying to talk you into coming for a little 15-minute flight, you know. So that was basically all we did, was scenic operations with that plane. The next job I took was in the Whitsundays, and that's a place in North Queensland. So we're up kind of past Brisbane to the north there. And the Whitsundays are this beautiful island chain of 74 islands and also on the Great Barrier Reef. And yeah. I was flying a Beaver float plane and a caravan on amphibs. And they were both on amphibs, sorry. And based out of an airport. And we were doing kind of more long tours. So rather than just scenic flights, we were going out spending anywhere up to 4.5 hours flying these guests around onto the beach. We're landing on the water there, putting them on one of the best beaches in Australia, then flying them out to the Great Barrier Reef, and literally going from being the captain of the plane to the captain of the boat when you take a little snorkeling boat down to an area where you could all snorkel, and spending, you know, an hour snorkeling the Great Barrier Reef with these passengers before, you know, heading back to the airplane and taking off. So once again, yeah, more of a tourism based operation, that one as well. I don't think we really did any charters, other than maybe some transfers from resort islands to bigger islands or to airports. But other than that, yeah, it was all kind of scenic stuff. And then my flight plane career then took me over to Vietnam, which I did a bit of flying in Vietnam for a little bit.
Very interesting.
Which was out of Hanoi there. And that was, once again, just more tourism type stuff, transferring people to Ha Long Bay for their boat.
One of the baddest places of the planet.
Yeah, it does get a lot of pollution in there, Hanoi.
Really?
The pollution in Hanoi, especially in the winter there, it's regularly up there as one of the most polluted places on the planet, basically. Because if you look at a topographical map of Hanoi and northern Vietnam there, Hanoi actually kind of sits in a bit of a valley that runs out to the ocean there. And they're pretty high mountains all the way around it. I think they're up over 10,000 feet from memory. And I think the pollution and the haze just sits in that valley there and can't escape. So it all kind of just, yeah, sits right over the top of Hanoi. But, Ha Long Bay was beautiful. Ha Long Bay was a magical place to see from the air. I mean, over 1,000 islands and these beautiful rock-faced islands. that was a pretty incredible place, and I was pretty glad to say that I'd, you know, spent a year there flying. But we only kind of flew back and forth from Hanoi to that location in Ha Long Bay.
Yeah.
That was all the flying we did. So I didn't get to see a lot of the country. But and then now where I am now at Pass Bailey, they're flying the Mallard. The kind of flying we do here is mainly supporting our Pearl Farm. So it's private operations mainly. You know, we are basically the company ute, for example, for the company to run its pearling operations. I'm not sure if you've heard of Pass Bailey. They are basically the best pearls in the world. Our jewelry is some of the most amazing pieces of jewelry you'll see with natural pearls. So we farm a lot of our pearls out there, and so that's what we're doing. That's what we're using the Mallard there for, is transporting our passengers back and forth to those farms for their week, you know, 2 weeks of work. So our main work is those pearl farmers there going out to their, you know, 2 weeks on of work on a boat. But recently, the last kind of year and a half, we've been kind of moving down the alleyway of more commercial work. So where we're operated in Darwin, in the top of Australia here, it's so isolated. There's, you know, it's quite funny. Darwin is, it's closer to Bali than it is any other capital city in Australia. It's so isolated. And one of the great things about being so isolated is, say, for example, the fishing is so great. You know, there's just untouched areas all along the top end here that people can access. And there's a lot of fishing boats that go out there and do really good fishing trips. But when you're so isolated, it means that the boat has to go so far to go to these isolated spots, but then to come back to an airport, for example, takes, you know, almost a day of sailing to get back to that airport. So we can fly the passengers straight out to their boat, which is sitting in the middle of nowhere, land on the river right next to the boat there, pull up, and you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning, with just an hour and a half of flying, they're already being able to throw, you know, a lure in the water and start fishing straight away, so they don't have to worry about sailing for so long. So that's pretty incredible. And there's also a lot of some really isolated camps, like kind of like resorts along the coast there, and especially in the Kimberley in the top of Western Australia. So we fly guests out to those resorts as well, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah. And why do they use the Mallard? I mean, it's a pretty old aircraft, even if it's a very old fashioned and looks very nice, you know, kind of enjoyable aircraft. Why do they use it now? Don't they have something like more profitable, just something that is easier to employ?
It's a great question, mate, because, you know, the Mallard, there was 59 Mallards built ever back in 1946. So first of all, you have this huge issue with parts. We don't have, you know, we can't contact Cessna and say, hey, we need this new part here. Can you please send us this part? That really doesn't exist. So straight away, you have an issue with some components and parts that do not exist anymore. There's none left in the world. And we have to then go to manufacturing and engineering companies to basically remanufacture these parts, which is obviously very expensive. So that is one issue. The reason why we do have the Mallard still is because they can do what no other aeroplane in the world can do still. So like I said, with the top end here, everything is so far away and everything is so isolated. So we need to fly long distances all the time. So let's take probably the most comparable seaplane around at the moment would probably be the Twin Otter on amphibian floats. We TAS about 185 knots, basically. The Twin Otter, I'm not sure on amphibs, but I think it's only around about 130. So straight away, we're going faster. Because of we're not carrying floats around, it allows for a bigger payload. So for example, we can take, with 3.5 hours of flight fuel, around 1.2 tons of payload, which I know that you're a big jet captain or jet pilot in Hong Kong there, and saying 1.2 tons is probably absolutely nothing for you. But for what we need to achieve, that is that's basically what we take around all the time. We're taking out a lot of stores, sometimes 400, 500 kilograms of fresh food and everything to these vessels, and then passengers as well. So there is no other seaplane out there at the moment that can carry that much weight and be able to take the fuel to get that distance. So the Mallard, like if you were design an aeroplane for our operation right now, you would design the Mallard basically. So that they're doing basically whatever they can do to keep this aeroplane flying so that they can keep their purling operation running.
Yeah, that was my next point. With that kind of operation, I mean, the seaplane operations, 1.2, 1.3 tons is a pretty decent load. Even if in a commercial aviation, it's pretty low, in a seaplane operations, that's very high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Twin Otter is perfect for what it does, say, in the Maldives. It takes heavy loads. It probably takes just as much. I'm sure it probably takes over a ton of payload. I've actually been in the back of a Twin Otter on holiday to a resort island in the Maldives, and I was blown away. I think we had like 17 passengers on board, and there was suitcases almost coming up into the cockpit. There was that many bags on board. But this plane just shot up into the air like it was like a helicopter, you know. They are incredible, but they're doing these short hops. They're, you know, 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, sometimes maybe up to an hour, I'm sure. But generally, they're taking heavy loads over short distances. Our shortest sector to our Pearl Farm is an hour and 50 minutes one way. So, and sometimes we can take return fuel.
It's kind of long haul operation for the seaplanes.
Yeah, it pretty much can be sometimes. You know, like we'll do a return to one farm, say on a Friday. We regularly go to this farm, which is 2.5 hours away, and you could just go there and back, and that's all you have to do for the flight, and you log 5 hours with one landing. You know, so it kind of is long haul water flying, and you know, for example, I did when I was in Geelong once. I did 23 water landings in a day and 8 hours of flight time. You know, I could do 8 hours of flight time up here and log one water landing. So it's not the job for constant water work. That's one thing I do miss with this job. We're not on the water all the time, but you know, the bonus is you get to fly this beautiful aeroplane, the Mallard. So that's what I'm loving at the moment anyway.
Talking about the Mallard, what's the main characteristics of this aircraft? Initially, I think it was piston engines. Now it's turboprop engines.
Yeah, so the original Mallard had some radial Pratt & Whitney's in it. And, you know, the PD6 wasn't around when the Mallard was built. You know, the PD6, it's so funny. Everyone talks about how amazing the PD6 is, and it is. It's an incredible engine, and it's been around for 50 years. But the Mallard's been around for 70 years. So when, you know, when the Mallard was built, the PD6 wasn't available. So, I think in the 70s, there was the first re-engineering of the Mallard. And I've been told before that when they designed the Mallard originally, they were looking for an engine with about 700 horsepower, but they didn't get that. I think the original engine had 600. And It performs better with the turbine engine in it. I mean, I haven't flown it as a radial, but I've been told that it was originally invented and produced for that extra power, and now it has it with the PD6 as well. So, yeah, one thing that people don't realize with our aeroplane is we actually have our own STC for the Mallard. So the story kind of goes back in the 90s there. The company bought three Mallards. Two were piston still, and one was the Frakes turbine conversion, which was done back in the 70s, as I mentioned. And the company had a lot of issues with the pistons, and they wanted the rest of them to be turbines as well. And they contacted Frakes, and they said, you know, can we look at getting these pistons done as turbine Mallards? And they wanted to take them back to America and get them done, or there was some issues there, which they didn't want to do. The company didn't want to do it. So they actually sent them to Perth, and they completely redesigned the whole aeroplane basically with the re-engineering, and they changed a few other things as well. So Yeah, our three mallards that we have are completely different STCs to all other mallards, including the other turbine mallard. So, yeah, not only has the engine changed, there's been other changes as well. When the company changed over the turbine engines, they also upgraded the avionics. But we've actually done another avionics upgrade recently as well, which is to the Garmin 750 and 650 suite. So they're both touchscreen GPSs there, kind of like the old 430 and 530 Garmins, but mm-hmm. a bit more advanced as well there. So, yeah, that's really good. One of our aircraft has actually got TORS system and GPWS as well installed. So that's handy, and that also increases our payload for commercial work. So we can, because it's a 13-seat aeroplane, we're not limited to 9 without that. So one of our aeroplanes, we can actually take the full complement of 13 passengers because of the GPWS system. It's just a regulatory issue there. So, but we don't have to do that with the private flying. So, yeah, there's been some changes there as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a kind of wheels mounted gears to be able to land as well on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it's an original amphibian flying boat. So we do land. We're operating at the airport there, at Darwin Airport, International Airport there. So they're kept in a hangar, just like most other fixed gear, you know, or retractable undercarriage aircraft. So we keep them at the airport. Yeah, that's another great thing about the Mallard is that it's basically just a normal, you know, high wing twin engine retractable undercarriage aircraft, and they've just beefed up the hull or the body, the fuselage, to be able to land on the water. So that's another, you know, that's what I love about the flying boat is you kind of look at it on the ground there at the airport, and if you don't know, you might actually just think it's just a weird looking high wing turboprop, you know, mm-hmm. Except for those weird things that drop off the wings, you know, they look like drop tanks, but yeah, you know, it's that's why it's a lot quicker as well, you know.
Yeah, do you use it sometimes for ground-to-ground operations?
Yeah, no, you can use it however you want, really. I mean, we actually have picked up a charter where we actually use it as a land plane only. There is an island in the top of Australia here that has a small community on it, and the school teachers are permitted to a certain amount of money from the government to fly on and off the island, and we quoted for it, and we got the charter, and they really like the service with the Mallard. You know, it's not pressurized, so we can't go that much higher than 10,000, which other aircraft can, but we still are quite big inside, so it's quite comfortable. We can carry big payloads, as I mentioned, and when you're only kind of going an hour and a half anyway, that extra speed of going up to flight levels really is not much of a big difference. You know, you might save 20 minutes. So, yeah, they really like us. But, yeah, it's a runway-to-runway charter. So, it's a bit odd, but it can be done.
Do you use it on a single crew operations or a multi-crew operation?
So, the original Mallard was built as a single-pilot aeroplane. When we did the turbine upgrade, we also did the gross weight increase, which took it above the 5,700 kilo limit, which mm-hmm. has made it a permanent multi-crew aeroplane. So for all operations that we do, it's all multi-crew, which is, mm-hmm. I think, is great. And, you know, the aeroplane is actually really hard to operate single pilot, not so much in the cockpit. I mean, I could literally get in there and fly it, no problems, single pilot, but it's a lot of the stuff we actually do on the water that is, you need the second guy. I mean, if you want to pick up a mooring, a lot of people have seen it on my Instagram. You know, we have this little tunnel basically that goes underneath the co-pilot's instrument panel, basically where their rudder pedals are. The co-pilot can crawl up underneath the panel there into the nose bay and pop open a hatch, and then they can pop out of that with the engines running and everything, and they can pick up a mooring for permanent mooring on the water there. So you can't do that single pilot. And also when we do our transfers on the water, there's a boat that comes up beside us at the back there to transfer the passengers and freight while the right engine stays running. you know, you wouldn't be able to do that just by yourself. So as mm-hmm. part of the operation, it's basically critical that we have two crew. Technically, yeah, as I mentioned, it's a single pilot airplane originally, but the way we run it is completely multi-crew, and I think that's a great thing as well. And it certainly helps when you do have those long sectors to have someone else to talk to keep you entertained.
Yeah, and not to die by boredom. Do you have any cabin crew as well? I don't think so.
No, we don't need cabin crew for our size, but we don't.
And so you've been running a podcast as well, On the Step with That Mallard Guy. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, mate. So, like I said, I've been at the company now with Passpaly for about 3 years, and I started an Instagram account showcasing all about what we do with the airplane. And I understand that, you know, it's approaching 20,000 followers now, which is pretty incredible. I understand that people don't follow this account for me. They follow it because of the incredible stuff we do with the Mallard, and you know, it's such a unique operation what we run there. So that success with the Instagram has been incredible, and the feedback that everyone's been giving me with that page has been really positive. And then when COVID hit, you know, back in kind of March, April, especially in Australia here, and that's the build, or that's our charter season starts basically then, and we lost all of our charters completely for the year. We were still doing our private flying for the Purling Farms, but you mm-hmm. know, I was looking at maybe a 3 or 4 day a week roster, and it kind of dropped back to one. So I had all this spare time in my hand, and just recently in the last few months, I'd been getting into podcasts with you know, my boy. I have an 8-month-old son now, and I was taking him walking every morning down on the water's edge where we live down here, and I was starting to get into podcasting, originally a golf podcast because I love golf, and I started listening to those, and then I was like, oh, wouldn't it be great to kind of learn some stuff about aviation as I was walking? And so I started to find these aviation podcasts, and I got into Justin's Pilot to Pilot podcast and started to listen to that. And I found myself going through his list of people and trying to find all the seaplane podcasts. And Dion Mitten, who I know you've spoken to, and I spoke to him as well on my show. And, you know, he had spoken to Justin, so I had to listen to his. And I found a couple of other guys who'd flown float planes. But all I wanted to do was hear float plane stories. So I kept searching for float plane stories out there, and there was really hardly any. So I was like, you know, I'd have a bit of experience with video editing before. You know, I'm not a professional or anything, but, you know, I've used Final Cut Pro, and I've used Photoshop for video for photo stuff. And I was like, I'd actually used GarageBand a fair bit as well. And I was like, you know, this can't mm-hmm. be this hard, this podcasting thing. So kind of did some Googling and did a bit of planning and decided on making this podcast all about seaplane stuff. So, yeah, look, On the Step is all about float planes and flying boats, and I try and interview people all around the world who have some dealings with seaplanes, and just kind of hear their story. And it's been a really incredible response so far. A lot of people have given some great feedback on the show and are really loving the conversation. So, it's been really great fun. I've been, you know, meeting some incredible people from around the world, and I've now got this bucket list of places that I want to see simply because of seaplane pilots and what they've told me. Mm-hmm. So, it's been really positive, and really enjoying it.
Yeah, it's very nice to be able to grow a show and to meet people from different areas, especially you, because the area of seaplane is pretty wide. And we've seen from North America to Australia, the other side of the world, you have a lot of pilots and a lot of interest, especially combining these kind of operations, seaplane operations, with warbird style aircraft.
Exactly, yeah. And it's such a niche part of aviation. I mean, you know, podcasts like Justin's with Pilot to Pilot, it's great because it covers everything. You know, you could be listening to a helicopter pilot one day, you could be listening to someone at AOPA, you could be listening to a seaplane pilot next, and then an airline guy, whereas, you know, I focus on my niche, which is the seaplane world. And, you know, I know your experience with being a fighter pilot, that's kind of like a similar niche. And there are some really cool fighter pilot podcasts out there. I know you spoke to one guy as well. So, yeah, it's really cool to kind of add that niche to the kind of stack of aviation podcasts that are out there. And, yeah, absolutely loving it.
We can find your podcast on all the conventional platforms. I mean, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, and all that kind of platforms.
I don't think it's on YouTube, but I'm not too sure if that automatically gets uploaded on there. But yeah, everything else like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, all of those ones that you normally find a podcast, you can check it out. Yeah, on the step with that Mallard guy.
Yeah, and all the listeners will enjoy it. Thank you very much, Daniel. It was a pleasure having you on the Nanjis podcast.
Mate, I really appreciate you having me on the show there. And it's really cool to connect with yourself and some other people doing this kind of stuff. I know being a podcaster myself now, only for a few months, how much effort goes in behind the scenes. So, well done to your show and congratulations on the hard work you've done. You've already got some incredible guests on your show, and I feel like I by no means stand up to some of those guys, especially people like Matt Hall, for example, who's a bit of an idol of mine. So I really appreciate you having me on the show, and hopefully if anyone loves seaplane or want to hear more stuff about seaplanes, come on over and have a listen. And but appreciate it very much.
You've been listening to the Nanjis podcast, an aviation podcast. If you liked this show, subscribe and share on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the podcast platforms, including YouTube. You can as well follow us on Instagram and Facebook on the Nanjis Podcast account. Thanks again for listening.